I'm Katie, mom to two littles and four angel babies.
And I'm Sarah, an advocate for moms and children of all backgrounds and family types.
With two PhDs between us and collective decades spent unraveling how society shapes women's experiences, we're here to shred the rule books and their relentless tide of expectations. In this safe space, the complexities of motherhood find a candid, unfiltered voice. We're Undefining Motherhood, one conversation at a time. I cannot overemphasize how excited I am to share this interview today. I've been hoping to get a one-on-one with today's guest basically since the moment I learned of her existence. I've talked a lot this season about my recurrent pregnancy loss experience, but I haven't said much yet about one of the most maddening parts of it all. When you're going through struggles like infertility or recurrent miscarriage, you'll often notice a burning desire to control as much as you possibly can because of so much that's out of your control. For me, and for the thousands of moms I've talked to over the years, some of these controllable things include vitamin supplementation and nutrition. But even something seemingly so simple gets really complicated, and I found this maddening during my recurrent loss journey. Doctors disagree on the importance of different nutritions, and for me, out of three different doctors, I had three different opinions on what needed to be in my prenatal vitamin. Meanwhile, social media influencers try to sell you supplements or diets without you really knowing if there's evidence behind them. And then there's the infighting between the nutritionists and the medical doctors. Nutritionists offer insights, pointing out that medical school doesn't include nutritional training, and medical doctors often respond with frustration, saying that perhaps people who aren't trained and involved in the medical treatment of pregnant people shouldn't be giving out advice to them. But even when the doctors disagree, how do you know who to listen to? This was an issue that left my head spinning during all of my losses and both of my successful pregnancies. That's why you've heard me talking all season about the GeneAid test and their new prenatal vitamin, because finally, someone has taken an interdisciplinary approach to getting us the answers we need. And here's what that means. OBs and obstetrical researchers are talking to nutritional researchers, and we're actually starting to have conversations that give expecting parents answers instead of more questions. And that, friend, is why I am so excited about today's guest, because she is a huge part of pioneering this desperately needed interdisciplinary work. Dr. Camille Hoffman is a professor of maternal fetal medicine at the University of Colorado Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology and Psychiatry. She received her medical degree from the Medical University of South Carolina, completed obstetrics and gynecology residency at the University of Miami, and she completed her maternal fetal medicine fellowship at the University of Colorado Medical School. She also completed a fellowship in integrative medicine through the University of Arizona in 2018. I can go on and on about her credentials, but here's the part that has had her on my radar as a must-have guest on this podcast. Dr. Hoffman has become so interested in maternal health outcomes and nutrition that she has actually become expert in both worlds. Some of her latest research shows incredibly promising results, showing that integrating choline supplementation and psychotherapy into standard prenatal care can improve the mental and physical health and wellness of pregnant people and their children. Research has also shown that this same supplementation is essential for helping to prevent neural tube defects. I am truly honored to introduce you all today to this woman who is quite literally changing the world for moms. Welcome to Undefining Motherhood, Dr. Camille Hoffman. Thank you so much for being with us here today, Dr. Hoffman. I am so excited to get to talk to you and just learn some of the vast amounts of knowledge that you are carrying around in your brain that is so essential for all of our listeners, all of the parents, and especially the moms in our community to know more about, whether we're in the trying to conceive phase, pregnancy, postpartum. And honestly, even the work you're doing, I think extends far beyond that. And it's really things that we carry into the rest of our lives as moms. So thank you for being here. I would love to just get started with getting to know you a little bit better. How did you, as a maternal fetal medicine specialist and an OBGYN, decide, hey, I want to start learning about nutrition?
That's a great question, and I'm honored to be here. Thank you for having me. All throughout my teenage years and undergraduate years, I was really interested in complementary and alternative medicine. And originally, actually wanted to study midwifery and become a midwife because that seemed to blend the world of nutrition and holistic health better than what my view of conventional medicine was at the time. There's still some truth to that today. But along that path, obviously, I kind of went the medical route. And part of that was in wanting to have my own autonomy or more autonomy in decision making.
Yes.
So once I went through my medical school training and OBGYN residency, and then did a fellowship in high-risk obstetrics or maternal-fetal medicine, I got through my board examination process, those kind of things that you do as a junior faculty, and at the same time had started to do research with some colleagues in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. And so was at that time studying really the impact of stress and mood on pregnancy outcomes, but pretty short-sighted. I mean, I am an obstetrician, so we're more accustomed to focusing on preconception health, pregnancy, and then as soon as the delivery happens, kind of handing off the babe and thinking, all right, good luck, hope everything goes well, and mainly having the end game to us be what's the gestational age at birth and what's the birth weight. But in working with psychiatrists and psychologists for research, I realized there was far more to the story than simply the gestational age of delivery. And that was only one marker of what life course health might look like for that family. And also, as part of that research project that we were working on at the time, and we still do very similar research studies as far as their design today, we do more extensive psychiatric intakes or histories on everybody who participates, regardless of their scores being high or low or positive or negative. And when I started to look at those data, I also noticed a really high risk of depression or anxiety or history of these conditions. And that really launched my pursuit of more training in perinatal mental health care and how nutrition and mental health and pregnancy health and postpartum health and then your child's brain development all are closely related.
Yes.
So then ultimately, I think as part of that, but I came back to my roots and thought, you know, I still really do care about this integrative medicine side. And integrative medicine is another word for the blending of complementary and alternative medicine that has an evidence base with Western medicine. So I did a fellowship through the University of Arizona, and that's just enabled me to blend all of those things in a way that's really harmonious in the patient care that I now provide.
It's amazing what you're doing. The way I have kind of talked to my community about this, what you're calling integrated medicine fits into, because I'm also an academic, fits into that academic arena of interdisciplinarity. And, you know, I've been talking about how one of the things that we're missing so much in our current medical approaches to how we treat women preconception, pregnant, during loss, and especially during postpartum, really takes this very singular approach. And if we can bring in the insights and the understandings of the psychologists and the psychiatrists, the nutrition researchers, the humanists, the social workers, we can have a much more patient-centered approach. And so I am so thrilled to get to talk to you because, like, you're doing this. You're pioneering that work that is actually going to make the world better for mothers. And that is just, I mean, I'm glowing. If people are watching the video version of this, they can see I'm literally glowing. I'm so excited to be able to have this conversation with you. So talk to us a little bit, and this can be both about mom or this can be about baby, about the role that nutrients in general play on brain development. And for mom, I think, and you, correct me if I'm wrong, for mom, that's going to mean more from a mood and potentially psychological outcomes angle. And for baby, that's going to be more cognitive development. So tell us, just as we get into this conversation, why does this matter? Why should we care about our nutrition? And when we say that, we mean our supplementation, we mean the food we're putting into our bodies, we mean that in a holistic way. Why does this matter, preconception, pregnancy, and postpartum?
That is such a great question. And it, I'm going to try and make have a succinct answer. So for...
it's so many questions in one. It can't be succinct, but I'll keep us online.
Maybe it's easiest to start with the fetus who becomes the baby and the child. So you're building, when you are pregnant, you're building a human being from scratch, from two cells. And so I talk to my patients about, you know, you want to grow this new human with the best building blocks. And most of that is from the nutrition, and the placenta is what is the, who is the supplier of that nutrition. So it's entirely dependent on what the mom eats. And I try to be really cautious about not imposing guilt on a mom when she wants to eat a chicken sandwich or a milkshake. That's fine. I did those same things in my pregnancy. And at the same time, it's important to have most of your dietary intake be anti-inflammatory style foods. We know that that's the best way for us to eat in our diet. And I'm going to circle back to that on the impact on the mom, but also for the fetus and placenta, because the placenta hates inflammation. Most recently, we have COVID as the prime example of that and the changes that we saw in the placenta related to all of the inflammation mm-hmm. that COVID instigated or caused. Mm-hmm. But for the fetus, that also translates to the whole body, but primarily the brain. The brain, especially in the second trimester, is very sensitive to maternal and placental inflammation. So that's where a lot of my research work kind of targets, okay, what can you do to bolster and buffer that fetal brain from things that a mom may or may not be able to control as far as what she consumes or what she's exposed to in pregnancy. But an anti-inflammatory, I don't have one diet that fits all. I don't believe that that exists because everybody has different metabolisms and microbiomes. But the main principles are
yes.
avoiding trans fats and manufactured fats. Those are very inflammatory. Things like high fructose corn syrup and high processed sugar, also very inflammatory. And we know this in outside of pregnancy human health, but it also applies to pregnancy health. So I mainly focus on good fats.
Absolutely.
Choline, obviously, good sources of protein and clean carbs.
Yes. So let's translate this into language for someone who doesn't know anything about nutrition. Basically, you're giving us, and tell me if I'm correct, you're giving us the advice that we've heard so many times. It is basically where we can shop on the outside of the grocery store and not in those middle aisles.
100%.
You say choline, we're talking eating eggs.
Salmon is a perfect pregnancy food.
Salmon, yes. Okay, and for a mom who hates salmon, what's a good alternative for the fats and the omega-3s? Is it nuts? Like, where can she go?
For a mom who needs the omega-3s, who's a vegetarian, I guess, there are omega-3s in fats, in nuts. Primarily, those are ALA,
yes.
or alpha-linolenic acid. And there's only about a 10% conversion to the DHA that we are really targeting. So a vegetarian mom, as far as omega-3s, might want to consider something like a krill oil or some kind of other, or maybe just take some mm-hmm. omega-3 out of small cold fish capsules.
Yes.
Soy products like soy lecithin are great sources of choline for vegetarians. And choline is primarily in eggs, salmon, animal livers, but I always joke with patients about 2 moms per year like liver. Everybody else wants to gag because they're also pregnant when I'm telling them.
Especially while pregnant, right? I actually do like it not pregnant, but during pregnancy, yeah. I don't think I could go there.
Exactly. But plenty of beef, chicken. And so then it's just more, you know, those 3 foods, the eggs, salmon, and liver are kind of the easiest because 3 to 5 ounces or 3 to 4 eggs are going to get you to the choline levels that we're targeting. But that's still a lot to consume every day, especially when you're pregnant with how your taste and your tolerance for foods change.
It is. It is. And so we're going to come to that. And for those of you who are loving this and think, oh, I want more, we're going to do another episode where we're going to interview Kara Everett, who is a genetic nutritionist for moms in this same stage. And so we're going to get all of that detail. What I wanted here was to just do a quick, like, here's a quick overview. Here's how this translates. And also, you know, just like reminding us how much you know about this. Because really, what we see so often in the world of medicine and nutrition is that there's a lot of argument that goes on. And I have a lot of personal experience with this. And so I'll keep my story brief because everyone here has heard it. But I had 4 pregnancy losses before I had my son, Jack. I learned lots of things about my body at that time. And I really wanted to control my nutrition and to control my vitamin and supplement intake because it felt like one of the few things that I could control. But my doctors didn't agree on the vitamins, and we'll get more into why that is in a little while because I want to make sure we finish answering this first question. But ultimately, the doctors didn't agree on what vitamins I should be taking. I ended up doing a Whole30 diet because I wanted to do something anti-inflammatory, and I had one doctor who was like, this is amazing, you go. And then I had 2 others who were like, why in the world are you doing that? And so, you know, what we get is we get this really tricky world in which different doctors tell us different things. Nutritionist influencers on the internet are telling us certain things, and we don't know who to trust because they're not involved in patient care. You're doing all of it, and you're doing it all both clinically and in research. And so I love hearing what we just heard from you as a way of really understanding for our listeners the value of the voice that you can provide that we just can't find and all of the other places. So thank you for that. Okay, so we've got kind of the importance of the nutrients. So I have a quick side question, and then we're going to go back to the main one. So we're talking about the importance of nutrients. We've seen that this is really important for fetal brain development, cognitive development, and you said particularly in the second trimester. Is that right?
Right.
So as someone who also deals in maternal psychology, how do you then talk to the mom who says, that all sounds great, but I have HG or I have severe morning sickness? And I know a lot of, I had this with my daughter, and I know a lot of people who, a lot of our community has gone through this, where we're then, we want the information, we want to know what our nutrition should be like and what supplements we should take, but then we also feel guilty because maybe we can't swallow that pill and maybe we can't eat that food. And I survived a trimester on Honey Nut Cheerios, and donuts.
Yeah.
So like, how do we talk to and support those moms? And then we're going to come back to the question about maternal mood, because I think that's going to be directly connected to this.
Okay. So with a condition like hyperemesis gravidarum, fortunately, most of those moms will start to improve towards the end or beginning of the second trimester. And so when I see a patient and all she can eat is Honey Nut Cheerios or mashed potatoes or bagels during the first trimester, I say, it's okay. You know, at some point you have to just be able to have some kind of food consumption, stomach the supplements that you can. There is a liquid form of choline that sometimes goes down a little better in the first trimester and it's small volume. But really, since our studies and other groups really focus on more like 16 weeks, 18 weeks, And in the third trimester studies that exist out of the group, a group in Rochester, really third trimester, most of the time you've been able to kind of help people get on some kind of nausea regimen by then,
yes,
that they can start to then integrate. And in an ideal setting, we've already met, or at least the patient has some notion of nutrition preconceptionally. And so then if she has good choline intake and good just overall nutrition going into pregnancy, well, one, like you mentioned, that's going to help with conception and promote better implantation, a better overall pregnancy. And so then you can have kind of the grace period of the first trimester when everything tastes different than it used to, or the things that you used to love make you gag.
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of target, all right, get through that. Let's find an appropriate either medication regimen or supplemental regimen for your nausea, and then focus on then getting back onto something like, yeah, Whole 30, paleo, anti-inflammatory, Mediterranean, wall protocol. Those are all very similar in their focus on anti-inflammatory foods and avoidance of highly inflammatory foods.
Yes. And I love that you just gave us so many, because it's so supportive of that notion that, look, the same thing is not right for everyone. And so that's such an important reminder for us. And so if we're able to then get these nutrients, and right now we're talking about nutrition, about the food that we put in our body. I do want to also talk about the supplements, but we're going to get there in a minute. You said we see real improvements in fetal cognitive development. I know also we see improvements, you haven't mentioned this yet, but in things like neural tube defects,
yep,
right?
Yep.
So not just talking about, you know, if we're consuming good forms of folate, things like, you know, leafy green vegetables, but also I believe research, and please confirm this for me, is showing that things like choline and betaine are also really important. And those are in the foods that you have just been talking to us about. So we understand there's a lot that can benefit the child here.
Right.
And I'm just saying things in my language because I talk like a person who's not an expert in nutrition or obstetrics. And so I know people can understand it. So just confirm if I'm getting this right for me. We like to start with foods, a food first approach, because foods are the most bioavailable nutrients, which basically means, yes, so we absorb the nutrients from our foods better than we absorb them from our vitamins.
Yes.
So that's why we're hitting this first. We are going to get to supplementation, though. So we know how this is all benefiting fetal development, but you're also doing research on how it benefits maternal mood. And undefining motherhood is a space that is very concerned with mama and with taking care of mama and helping her feel better. And I had severe postpartum anxiety with my first, and honestly had perinatal anxiety as too, and just didn't get that diagnosed because it wasn't debilitating the same way. So talk to us about the impacts you're seeing of these foods on mood, on if there are indications relating to perinatal mood and anxiety disorders. What are you seeing there?
Yeah, so there is a really strong correlation. I don't know this body of data as well, but with the gut-brain axis and how the microbiome plays into that.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that most of the body's serotonin is actually in the gut. Not that that directly correlates with something like an SSRI or selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor or an antidepressant medication, but that the gut and the brain communicate in a way that is influenced by what we expose our gut to, and that's our food, what we intake, what we swallow.
Yes. And can you just, quick pause, can you tell us what is serotonin for anyone who doesn't know?
Serotonin is a neurotransmitter that is involved in mood. Like other neurotransmitters involved are dopamine, epinephrine, norepinephrine, serotonin, oxytocin. But things that impact the brain.
So these are the things that are making us feel happy, feel sad, feel anxious.
Right. And have other physiologic functions in our body outside of our brain,
mm-hmm.
but all of these systems communicate. So I know that there are studies that have looked at mood, and specifically with certain probiotics that can improve depressive symptoms, improve anxiety. And I think there are a fair number of studies out there that also look at anti-inflammatory diets and their impact on food. And the same, there are studies that look at the impact of anti-inflammatory diets on pregnancy outcomes.
Yes.
So it only seems logical and reasonable to me that if you're trying to have a positive impact on both.
Yes.
And we know that there is a high correlation between a lot of inflammation and depression, along with all of the mm-hmm. other things. We know that inflammation impacts diabetes, heart disease, dementia.
Yes.
I mean, all of these things kind of unfold over the life course. And we know that they're related to long-term inflammation exposure.
Yes.
So we also think of pregnancy as a condition that unmasks your predisposition to life course health later on. We know someone mm-hmm. with gestational diabetes is more predisposed to developing type 2 diabetes later, especially if no lifestyle changes are made. Or preeclampsia,
exactly.
Unmasks a predisposition towards high blood pressure or cardiovascular disease yep. later. And the same, depression in pregnancy or postpartum depression. One, the biggest risk factor for them is a history of depression. But then we know that is, okay, this is the first episode. So here's another thing we need to pay attention to as this mom goes on through her life.
Yes, I love this. And I love that the ideas you're bringing to us are saying if we can help, even in small ways, if we can influence these factors with what we're putting into our bodies during preconception, pregnancy, postpartum, we can continue those influences
yeah.
for the rest of our lives.
Yeah.
So what do you advise patients in terms of preconception? When would you, when I said we did Whole30, I did not do that while pregnant. I did it during my recurrent miscarriage journey. I was between WAS 3 and 4, and we took a break
mm-hmm.
to do the little bit of remaining testing and to just get into a mental place. And I had found out I had chronic endometritis, and I had been treated with a giant antibiotic regimen, and I had still had another loss. And I said, I just want to do anything I can to reduce inflammation. I didn't even know what that meant at the time. I was just like, what can I find out about it? And so it happened to work out that the summer after I finished my PhD, I was starting teaching at Georgia Tech in the fall, and I had this whole summer where all of a sudden, for the first time in my adult life, I had nothing to work on, nothing hanging over my head. And so I said, well, we're trying to figure out having a baby, and so I'm going to spend all my time in the kitchen. And it made it where Whole30 for me was fun. It was not difficult. Now I can't even fathom doing it because I have 2 children. But at the time, I could cook 3 meals a day, and it was a fun summer, and it gave me control over something, and my RE was all about it. My reproductive endocrinologist, for anyone not in the fertility world, the person managing recurrent pregnancy loss or fertility treatments, said, I'm not going to promise you it's going to help, but I certainly isn't going to hurt.
Right.
So go for
right.
it. So when do you start talking to patients? When do you suggest people start that sort of preconception planning in terms of nutrition and supplementation? And then we'll move over into the supplementation world a little bit.
I guess the easiest answer is as early as possible.
Yes.
If we think about ways that other systems of medicine target preconception health and conception, I usually tell patients that my understanding of traditional Chinese medicine is that they are targeting the egg that is ovulated 3 cycles down.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever I talk to a patient about, well, maybe start some acupuncture, and that is targeting 3 ovulations from now. So don't think this, maybe you get pregnant next month and that will be great. Congratulations. On the other hand,
yes.
if you're really trying to optimize in this other system that does consider energy flow in the body and inflammation would interrupt that, then 3
mm-hmm.
months, 3 months, 6 months out to really de-inflame yourself.
Yes.
And target that conception.
Are you familiar with the book, It Starts with the Egg?
I've heard of that book, yes.
You've heard of it. I'm always curious. I want to find, someday I'm going to find the, if there out there is a version of you who is a reproductive endocrinologist, I want to know. Because yeah. I want the person who knows medicine and nutrition's opinion on this book and the supplement recommends, because it is very controversial. Some people swear by it, and some people say this is someone just trying to make a lot of money off of you and sell you supplements. And I don't know where to land. And so we're going to find that out one day. Okay, so let's talk then about something that you know so much about. And I have been talking about this all season when I have been talking in our ads about GNATE and the GNATE tests and their new prenatal vitamin. They are, full disclosure, sponsoring this episode, and I'm so grateful for it because they were able to put me in touch with Dr. Hoffman, which was so exciting for me. And what they are looking at that I think is so interesting is the specific genetic pathways that all of the vitamins, nutrients, fatty acids that go through our bodies have to go through to be absorbed. And so we'll hear a little more about this when we talk to Kara probably. But basically, the way it is was described to me is, you know, imagine you're driving down the road and there's construction going on and a road is blocked and we have to find ways around those blockages. And so what this test does is it tells us nutritionally, here's where your blockages are. And then what the results, and if you do nutritional counseling afterwards, are doing for us is telling us, here are your ways around these blockages. So that test is focused on these blockages are called SNPs. Is that right?
Yes.
Yes. So the blockages are called SNPs. And so what they're really looking at and trying to help us do both with our food intake and our supplementation is make sure that we're learning individually how to get around these roadblocks or SNPs. And they're focusing specifically on what they call one carbon nutrients, which is what you have been talking about, mm-hmm. right? But just for clarity, can you tell us what a one carbon nutrient is? What does that mean?
So one carbon nutrients or single carbon metabolism are pretty much what are the building blocks of our DNA. So how we synthesize or build DNA, which leads to the production of all of the things we need for our bodies to exist and to function. But the main ones we think about as far as pregnancy are folate and choline and its metabolites like betaine.
Okay, so I would love to, this is where I'm really excited to dig in. And I want to start with choline because I feel like choline is kind of the lesser known, but newer, it's the nutrient that's getting a lot of attention. Historically, our prenatal vitamins, especially like the white labeled prenatal vitamins that you buy at the grocery store, which just means like maybe one company manufactured the same vitamins and multiple companies are selling that exact same vitamin under their label. Historically, those have not had high amounts of choline in them. But if we, let's say that we wanted to get all of our nutrients from all of our choline, and phosphatidylcholine as well, which I only know because I know that this is where I have a SNP, a blockage, and I need to get that choline.
Okay.
That meat-based choline because I took the GNATE test. So if we're trying to say, forget supplementation. I mean, of course, every expecting and I hope preconception parent is taking a prenatal vitamin.
Yeah.
But let's say we want to try to get all of the choline that we need during pregnancy. With a normal person who does not have the blockages I have, how many eggs or pieces of salmon are we going to need to eat in a day?
I think in terms of the data that we have and a couple of other groups. So really the recommended daily allowance for choline is 450 milligrams. In the form of phosphatidylcholine, that translates to about 4,500 because you get about 10% of choline out of that phosphatidyl group, even though the phosphatidyl group is what helps with absorption amongst numerous different types of SNP profiles.
Yes.
So our research group, though, for many years and two other research groups have really done comparisons of this 450 milligram minimum to about double that, 900 milligrams. And so to get that amount in food, you are talking about 3 to 4 eggs. Minimum large eggs, or about at least 3 to 5 ounces of salmon or liver. And so while, yes, it is, like we've discussed, the diet is the best way to get all of that choline and kind of bypass any of these roadblocks or get through them.
Yes.
It's also not practical
to
be cooking maybe that much, especially if you do already have other children or you have other things that you do in life. And so that's where the supplements really come in. And when we think back to 20 plus years ago, when the folate studies were being done to see how, what combinations of folate, was it only dietary? Was it a supplement plus dietary? Was it to just something that should go in a prenatal vitamin, which is what ultimately happened. We know that the risk reduction for neural tube defects was most or largest when it was a combination of diet and a supplement.
Yes.
So we think the same is true for choline. And sometimes I call choline, I hope will become the little sister of folate because it is equally important. Just the benefits of it are not as easily seen or identified at birth or prenatally because it isn't as related to neural tube defects as folate.
Right. But let me ask you this. Okay, so we're going to get into folate more because that's like the elephant in the room in this conversation that we got to make sure we hit on.
Yeah.
I know both from recurrent pregnancy loss testing, where I found out that I have a heterozygous MTHFR variant, genetic variant. And what this means is we hear about this all over the internet, right? So if you're hearing this right now, like, I just want to clarify for you a few things that I do know to be true. Almost 50% of the population has this variant. There are various types of variants that are more severe in terms of your ability to process folic acid and metabolize that as folate than others. And it's also not just about that, right? It's also, so when I got my GeneAte test results back, they were looking at a few, like that entire pathway. So it wasn't actually just that they're looking at my MTHF. Do I have an MTHFR variant like half of the population does? They were also looking, I have actually have them in front of me in hopes that I can like locate this information really quickly. But they were also looking at, I can't find it. I don't know where it is in here. It's fine. I won't take our time on that. But they're looking at other more in that methyl pathway.
Right.
So if I am struggling, personally me, to turn folic acid into folate, because I know I am from my GeneAte test, even more than I did from my MTHFR results, because that just, I have the most common ones. And so based on that, I can still, I think my understanding is I can still mostly turn folic acid into folate, but not entirely. But we know from my GeneAte test that I have multiple blockages in that methyl pathway. So there are reasons that folic acid is potentially more difficult for me. Am I correct in my understanding then that we're talking about ways around these roadblocks? So one of the things one of my doctors recommended was that I just take a higher dose of folic acid to make sure I absorbed it, which there are conversations to be had about. But is it true that by increasing my choline intake, I am also better allowing my body to work around that roadblock and absorb folate the way that I need to?
Yes. And so different SNP profiles are one thing that impacts that, how choline and folate impact each other's absorption. Omega-3 fats also, DHA, helps facilitate that absorption. And things like stress, which is directly correlated with mood, will also lead women to sequester choline in their livers, to hold on to it for themselves. So something like stress can also impact how your body absorbs those nutrients. Your microbiome can do it. Some of that could be genetically influenced. Some of that is environmentally influenced. And then other exposures. Alcohol is a common one that we understand, that whenever someone consumes a lot of alcohol, the body needs more folate to kind of help repair and cope with that metabolism. And so then in the case of pregnancy, moms will also recruit more choline to kind of be able to utilize their hold onto their choline in order to be able to utilize that folate. But that all in our minds and in our opinions and in the data lead to less available folate and choline across the placenta to the fetus.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so what are you telling your patients to do about that? What are you recommending to them?
Well, I definitely tell them not to drink alcohol. Preconceptionally, I talk about if a patient has already had a GNAT test or some other kind of MTHFR testing, then we talk about, well, what types of folate are going to be better. Typically, I would just lean towards a methylated form of folate. They're usually in higher quality prenatal vitamins and are going to help you through the MTHFR, at least roadblock that you've already mentioned that 50% of people have. So I think that that's a more pragmatic approach to that.
Mm-hmm.
By itself. I also recommend, and I start talking about choline preconceptionally, and I talk about omega-3 fats preconceptionally.
Right. Okay. So a lot of conversations that are happening around folate versus folic acid, like it's a big discussion. Right. And it's a difficult discussion. People get very heated over this subject. And I understand why. Right. Because we want to make sure that we're minimizing the risk of neural tube defects in the fetus and giving them, you know, giving our fetuses the best chance possible of having everything cognitively the way we want it. Optimizing them just in every possible way. So I get that. We have people in the folic acid camp, and I understand the folic acid camp because that is the camp that is the only, in my understanding, please tell me if I'm correct here, it's the type of vitamin nutrient. One, we know it's the cheapest, and so it makes for cheaper prenatal vitamins, which are more affordable to, you know, everyday people. And two, it's really the one that we have the studies on. So we know, you know, what most doctors will say is, I can't recommend to you folate because we don't have studies on folate. We have studies on folic acid. And so, like, I had one doctor tell me I needed methylated folate. I had one doctor tell me I needed folic acid. And then my MFM said, if I were you, I would just take both. And so that's what I did. And so it's clear that your stance on this is that there really is a strong genetic component. So how important do you think it is that we understand our own genetics, that we have the ability to do something like the GNAT test? You know, there's a big push to actually get rid of MTHFR testing during the recurrent miscarriage and infertility testing process because doctors are complaining it's pushing people to take folate when they need to be taking folic acid because it's all that's proven. So, you know, I think this takes me to just a lot of different questions, sort of what is your take on this? But also, what does this say to us about the importance of getting that same kind of research that we have done for folic acid for folate? And is that even on, is that a possibility? How do we get that kind of research?
All right.
I gave you a lot and it's tricky.
So my belief about, well, whenever we do research, maybe our choline, contemporaneous choline studies aside, and whenever we do research, especially when we're thinking about research that happened 25 plus years ago, those investigators would have been using probably the easiest to access, cheapest form of folic acid.
Yes.
And on the one hand, that's great because there is a large proportion of the population who are not going to be able to afford or want to pay for the more expensive folate or prenatal vitamin. Yes. And most, in most states, when a prenatal vitamin is on a Medicaid formulary where I can then write someone a prescription for it and it be dispensed for free, that's probably going to contain folic acid. And that is a, that is to me primarily an issue of cost and different people's ability to pay for things and the health disparities that we know exist. I mean, that's a huge, another topic. But I think that that's probably why folic acid was the choice for the studies. To have the argument that, well, it hasn't been studied at, in folate means that you just don't understand the metabolism. And that's part of the biochemistry that we do learn in medical school. So I have a harder time saying, oh, well, it hasn't been studied in this downstream product that we're giving the folic acid for, so we can't apply it in clinical use. That doesn't, that's not an argument that really makes sense to me.
That's a very good answer. That's extremely helpful. Thank you. So how important do you think it is if patients have the ability that they do learn about their own genetics and try to adjust accordingly? You know, when I got my GNA test results, one of the things that I love is that I got, these are actually your new recommended daily values based on your genetics. And it wasn't just, oh, you need higher folate because of your folate, you know, your methyl pathways. It was also you need higher betaine because of this. And so, you know, how important do you think it is that we have that kind of insight and knowledge into ourselves if we have access to it?
If we have access to it, I think it's more important than a lot of the carrier screening that we do. Mm-hmm. We do carrier screens, we as a group, for, you know, there are panels now that are over 200 genetic disorders that are all extremely rare. Then the partner also needs to be a carrier of that. And then there's a 25% chance in most of these cases that the fetus would actually inherit both copies. And there's really nothing you can do about it.
Right.
And so for a lot of those, and that's where that carrier screening like that is pretty common.
And usually covered by insurance, right?
And usually covered by insurance. But this is something that gives you a target, something actionable that you can actually do to improve your fetus's health and brain development and thus entire life course. So it makes a lot more sense to me than there are some basic carrier screening panels that I definitely do and recommend and lean on. But some of these that are highly expanded, I really can't say that they are superior in providing information than what something like nutritional testing or even some of the genomic testing that can be done for different types of medications.
Yes.
Because those provide you something actionable.
Yes, exactly. Something very actionable and tangible. And it gives a really personalized approach to healthcare, which unfortunately we don't currently have a system that is set up to manage that. But if we imagined a world in which this was just part of the preconception process where we all had this covered test, how much better would our world look? Would our outcomes be a lot better, do you believe?
So all I can say at this point in time, are the only parallel I can make is that with choline, we believe that it is reducing the risk of mental illnesses that develop later in life in adolescence and early adulthood, things like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, earlier in life, we think that it also plays a role in maybe the development of ADHD. Certainly can also buffer fetal brains from pregnancy exposures like infection and a pandemic mm-hmm. that we just went through, alcohol exposure, cannabis exposure, stress and depression exposure. But if we have the impact that we hope for with choline on life course health, and then we think about what we've done with folate, which has reduced the risk of an open neural tube defect from about 1 in 1,000 to about 1 in 10,000. Varies a little bit by country, but that's kind of an order of magnitude lower.
Yes.
If we could do that with some of these mental illnesses, that would be huge, because these are things that occur in 1%, 2%, 4% of the population.
Yes.
And then would that be worth it as far as being covered by insurance? Who could argue that it wouldn't?
Right. The savings there. I mean, just from a capitalist perspective, the savings right. are obvious. Right. But I come from the humanist perspective that this is just what people deserve. But yeah, so.
Can I make one more comment about that?
Please do.
So we have some data. When we look at our African American participants in our choline studies, we know inside of pregnancy and outside of pregnancy that African American people have more stress.
Yes.
They are exposed to racism their entire lives, systemic,
yes.
personal. And we know that that, at least in research, translates to higher stress measures, however you capture it. We use hair and we look at cortisol. So we know in our African American moms, they generally have higher hair cortisol. So when we look at those moms compared to white non-Hispanic moms, we see that one, the cortisol is different, higher in the African-American moms. But in those moms who had higher choline levels early in pregnancy, their babies are likely to go on further in pregnancy, so lower risk of preterm birth and comparable neurodevelopment to babies who are term born whose moms had adequate or inadequate choline but weren't African-American in our studies. So we see some pathway on how choline may interact with one factor that influences the stress of African American moms more than
wow.
white non-Hispanic moms, but also that difference that might make in shifting gestational length or gestational age at birth a little bit higher, which we know is a huge disparity in this country, and then improve neurodevelopment, both because of that and because of the choline exposure on the brain. So I think in that way, we've been working in Colorado to try and get choline on the Medicaid formulary here so that we can improve access to it, because it is a supplement right now that isn't highly costly, but isn't also cheap.
Right.
And so we feel obligated to improve access if we're going to really
yes.
be able to impact the population at large. And those who are both wealthy and able to buy supplements on their own and those who are not.
Yes. Thank you for doing that work and that advocacy. Oh, my goodness. It's so needed. I know you have to go. So I'm going to ask you a very, very quick wrap-up question, because I know it's something that our audience is sitting here wondering. If you have a patient who comes in and they do have the access, they're willing to pay or able to pay for the higher end vitamin or supplement, what are you recommending to them? Do you have a supplement brand, or do you have, these are the things I want you looking for in your supplements? What are the recommendations that you're giving your patients today?
I usually start with the recommendations of the what I'm looking for.
Mm-hmm.
So we, in our research studies, we've used pretty high dose phosphatidylcholine for many of the reasons that we stated. We haven't been doing SNP testing. We don't do
yes.
microbiome testing. So we're like, all right, which one can we apply to the largest proportion of the population and know that they're going to get the amount of choline that we're targeting, which is that 900 milligrams. But so I'll say look for a supplement that contains minimum 450 if you're going to then, you know, also consume good dietary choline. or I'll mention some other brands. And Jenate now has a new supplement. So that hasn't before this point in time been one that I mentioned.
I cried when I saw the when I saw the nutritional values in it. I literally cried.
Oh. And I know that Jenate, along with some of these other brands, will also be on a site that's called FullScript.
Oh.
Which is a site, at least that's what they've told me, that is a site where all kinds of practitioners can kind of go in and vet supplements a little bit better. Mm-hmm. You know, they're a little bit higher quality. Doesn't mean they're the most expensive, fortunately.
Right.
But then they kind of baskets of recommendations for different supplement profiles for all kinds of conditions. Being pregnancy, preconception is only one of the many that exist on FullScript.
Yes. We'll link to that in the show notes so that that's something you all can check out and listen, look at. Dr. Hoffman, thank you so much for joining us today. It was one of the most educational hours of my life. If I could have talked to you 7 years ago, you didn't have all this information then, but oh my goodness, it would have been life-changing. So I'm so thankful that this information is available for moms now. I'm thankful for the research that you're doing, for the advocacy that you're doing to try to get these covered under Medicaid and just making sure that we can improve the physical health of moms and of fetuses and also try to close some of those racial and socioeconomic disparity gaps. So thank you so much. I appreciate you more than I can say.
You're so welcome. Such a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Friend, I hope you learned half as much as I did from this episode. I have been searching far and wide for someone with this level of expertise in both obstetrical care and nutrition, and having this conversation with Dr. Hoffman was a dream come true for me. I'm especially grateful to this episode's exclusive sponsor, Jenate by Snip Therapeutics, for connecting me with this incredible changemaker in maternal and fetal health. As you heard from Dr. Hoffman, there is so much you can do to learn about your own personal nutritional needs, whether you're trying to conceive, pregnant, or postpartum. That's why I'm so excited that Jenate is offering a special bundle that pairs the groundbreaking Jenate test with their top-of-the-line prenatal vitamin. This vitamin's formulation accounts for all of the research Dr. Hoffman and I discussed, plus so much more. Seriously, the research behind this vitamin is truly mind-boggling. Jenate is making personalized genetics and high-quality supplementation so much more accessible by bundling these products. With a 3-month prenatal subscription, you'll also receive a significantly discounted Jenate test with a free 30-day supply of prenatal vitamins. Learn more at undefiningmotherhood.com/Jenate and use code undefining10 for an extra 10% off. I am telling you, friend, you don't want to miss this offer. I cannot overemphasize the peace of mind these products would have given me during the most tumultuous years of my life. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the Undefining Motherhood podcast. It's been an honor to share this time with you. Remember, you're not just a listener, you're an essential part of our community. If today's conversation resonated with you, I have 3 simple requests for how you can help us grow. First, subscribe wherever you listened so you don't miss an episode. Second, we'd love it if you could leave us a review wherever you're listening to this podcast, as that's one of the most important ways we can grow and share our message and community. And finally, we'd love to hear from you. Jump over to Instagram and find us at Undefining Motherhood, where you'll see a post about this week's episode where we can continue the conversation. Thank you for being a part of the Undefining Motherhood community, where together, we're making change. Until next time, take care of yourself and each other.